Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have an exciting show. We have some guests coming up, but before that, I'm going to talk about the news with Alejandro. He is waiting patiently in the wings, and this has just passed a couple days ago, the 20th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights. So this evening, instead of the guests that we had lined up, Marcia Barnhart, she has laryngitis, by the way. She's rescheduled for the 29th. So I invited Dr. Lynn Kitai. She will be on, and so is the former Phoenix City Council member, Francis Barwood, that took all the grief during the Phoenix Lights right after the incident. She talked to something like 700 witnesses or something like that. And we also have a documentarian who's had some experiences of his own, Steve Lance. So those three will be on the show this evening. I want to tell you that the Everything Else show that we have, that is now being shared as a podcast to supporters of the show. So if you support the show for $2 or more per month, you get to listen to the Everything Else show as well with all different types of topics. Now, you may wonder why I'm not offering that free, and it's our bandwidth now cost, hundreds of dollars a month. So I really can't offer that free. But if you subscribe again for $2 or more, you get to listen to those shows too. And you can check out the website. The link is right on our homepage, podcastufo.com. And you can just check out the Everything Else show right by clicking there. Shows are now live stream on YouTube. You can watch the shows live during the show. It's also still posted as a podcast, nothing changes, and also is played on the Dark Matter Digital Network on Thursday nights from 10 to midnight p.m., and that's Eastern Standard Time. So that is it for me. Alejandro, welcome back from Mexico.
Gracias.
You must have had a wonderful time in the sun.
It was pretty great, yeah. The beach was beautiful. Lots of crazy party kids out there, but otherwise, yeah, it was the beach itself was wonderful.
Yeah, and that's you actually drove there, right? It was 4 hours.
Yeah, I drove. It's only like 4 hours from here. It's my first time there because usually, if I'm thinking of driving a little longer, I'll just go to San Diego, which we go to quite a bit. But this time, we went down to Rocky Point. They have good prices on stuff, and the town itself can be a little sketchy, but the resorts are gorgeous and very nice, and so it was a lot of fun.
Now, is the sand down there like a brown sand? I remember that in Mexico, driving down the Baja.
I mean, yeah, the beaches are very similar to California. The water, seems to be is about the same color. And the sand is about the same. So it's very nice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we got tons of snow here. We get 24 inches yesterday and last night.
So that's awful.
I'm longing for, going someplace like that. Any place warm actually would be nice right now.
I hear you. I'm from Colorado and I used to love the snow. Or at least, I didn't mind it. But now that I've experienced life without it, I prefer the without it part. And being cold is not fun. But so I'm sorry, my friend.
That's all right. So what's going on for the news this week?
UFOs, dude.
Bring it
on.
So,
yeah, you mentioned the Phoenix Lights 20th anniversary. So especially out here in Phoenix, we get a lot of stories on that, including Lynn Kitai. So on our Facebook, I posted a bunch of those stories. Nothing new, probably nothing much more than you'll hear from your interview, which will be a lot of fun. By the way, Frances Barwood, I think her is one of the most fascinating. Just even though she wasn't a witness, just what she experienced when she tried to investigate what was going on. It's incredible, the whole timeline of events that took place. And she spoke at our conference the first time that we had it in 2011 when we took it over. I was very excited to have her do that. And people can actually view that on our video streaming site or purchase a DVD at our site. But the point is that her whole story is really good. So if people want more, you know, they should check that out. It's just she's a great lady with a very interesting story. And I just think that when it comes to the Phoenix Lights, everybody needs to hear what she has to say.
Right, right. I know she went through such a hard time trying to get answers and, you know, no cooperation at all. I think she had some grief in the workplace too, didn't she?
Oh, yeah, she certainly did, which you'll have to ask her about. But, yes, she definitely did. And we also, I want to tell people that we posted a video about the Phoenix Lights. We have some interviews with the local Phoenix MUFON people who are great. And this is really cool. This is a piece of news, is that the Arizona Heritage Center, which is ran by the Arizona Historical Society, has this big, beautiful museum. And they worked with Phoenix MUFON to put up this great display. So they have a Phoenix Lights display there. And we interviewed the director of the museum, and we filmed that display. So you can see that in a video that we posted on Monday at our YouTube channel. So it's just really cool that the Historical Society would document this and boldly, you know, just put up this display.
I think that's great that they actually mm-hmm. did that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's only one other case I can think of that, and that's with Tom Reed. Tom Reed,
mm-hmm.
the Historical yeah. Society in his town put a monument. And yeah. I know there's also a Historical Society where the Betty and Barney Hill incident happened, too. So
exactly.
There's three of them that I can think of.
Yep, yep, yep. So, yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah.
So anything? In other news,
yeah.
Roger Marsh from MUFON posted at openminds.tv a story about a UFO pacing a vehicle in Washington. So we posted something like this not too long ago, where Roger posted a report from 1999 in California where a white orb kind of followed or was in front of a vehicle for a period of time. And this is a similar story. This is in Sikkim, Washington, and this story is also historical. It comes from 1994, but this person says they were driving towards the Strait of Juan de Fuca on January 15th when this incident occurred. They said they caught a glimpse of like a reflection of this object, and then they actually saw it with their own eyes, this green orb that was about 30 to 40 feet from their car and 25 to 30 feet off the ground. They said they think it was about 4 feet in diameter. He notes that he thinks he's pretty accurate because he's a carpenter by trade. But the object kind of moved around into the front of their vehicle, and he was not alone when he saw this. He said his buddy had at one point when he saw it, you know, said, "What the hell is that?" And when he noticed the object. But and after a little while, it just took off at a great speed. It moved so fast. Fast that they said they could see a visible line in the night sky. Pretty weird.
Yeah, that's another strange one.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, really weird sighting.
Yeah. Another, it has to be intelligent control. That's the only thing I can think of.
So, I mean, if it happened in the way that they reported it, which, you know, these orb type of objects following cars, we talked about this with the California thing, they're reported quite a bit. I know in Colorado in the San Luis Valley, where I used to spend some time, I had some roots there. Chris O'Brien wrote a book about it. They have a lot of reports of people traveling along those straight, long highways in this valley surrounded by big, giant mountains in Colorado. And it's a huge valley, though. And so as they're driving across it, people say they see these orbs that kind of follow their car for a period of time or fly around their cars. So, pretty weird. Don't know what to make of that.
Right. Now, so when you said you lived in that area for a while?
No, my family's roots are from the area. I would go camping there once or twice a year. But I didn't actually live there.
Now, did you know about the things going on when you were visiting the area?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I can't think of when I caught wind of the strangeness in the San Luis Valley, but I think when I was very young, my grandmother had a story of she claimed that when she was a little girl, she was playing under the table and some man came pounding at the door. And when they opened the door, he's an excited person with a gun. And he said he had been chasing a 6-foot-tall flying mantis around. And so she said, like, you know, one of the men grabbed a gun and go help him. And that's the extent of the story. Wow. So, yeah.
That's
so
a bizarre one. Jeez.
Yeah. So.
Now, I don't know. Is that what first got you interested in the subject? I don't know if we've ever talked about that.
No, I wouldn't say that. It would be other reports and things like that. But that would a little bit. I mean, I was open to ideas about the paranormal all along.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, so is that it for this week?
That is it for the news this week.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.
No problem. It's my pleasure. Read more at openminds.tv. And I guess we'll be talking to you next week. You have a good one.
All right. You too. Now for a treat, Mark Stanley is a listener of this show. And he wrote a song, Out of the Sky, a number of years ago. And we're going to be playing that. It's actually about Roswell. I hope you enjoy it. And here it goes. Stay tuned for our guests.
Out on Brazil's farm, there's a lightning storm, but there's another light in the sky that night in the Roswell clay. When the sun came up that day, pieces of some machine no one had ever seen. Out of the sky it fell, in July it fell, but don't ever tell. Out of the sky it desert wind, as if it had never been carried off somewhere, but it once been there, nothing left behind for anyone to find, not a single trace left from this time and place. Out of the sky July it fell, but don't ever tell. Out of the sky it fell. And the secrets that they keep run so wide and deep. It was 60 so much we don't know. Out of the sky it fell, in July it fell, but don't ever tell. Out of the sky it fell. Thank you.
You are calling does not accept unidentified calls.
All right. Hang in, everyone. This has happened before, and I did alert Lynn that I would be calling from an unknown number. So let me try again here on another number. She did give me two numbers, and we'll give this one a try here. I hope you like the song.
Your calling does not accept unidentified call.
Okay, isn't that fun? Okay, you know, I'm going to have to bring in one of our other guests. And let's bring in Lance. And I'm sorry, Steve Lance. That's who we'll be calling right now. And hopefully we won't get the same message.
You are calling does not accept unidentified calls. If you are...
All right, you know what? I'm going to call Francis. I warned all these people that this this was happening. And, okay. So, this is Francis Barwood. Hey, we got our phone ringing, didn't we? Francis?
Oh. Uh-huh.
Hi, Francis. This is Martin Willis. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
You're probably wondering why I'm calling so early. And I will tell you that I warned both Steve and Lynn that I'd be calling from an unknown number. That's the only way Skype calls. And they both have blocks. So so I'm putting you on now, and I'm gonna tell them, you know, they have to...
Uh-oh, I got to get you off my off my computer here. Okay.
Okay, you got that? Okay, very good. All right, so let me
I'm
just...
Here.
You're here, okay. All right, thanks. So let me just... I just have to communicate with them real quickly, and I'm sorry to the live listener, but I just want them to know that I can't reach them.
Well, they may be listening, so they would realize, but...
Hopefully.
Yeah, I knew you were going to come through restricted.
Yes, yes. So, yeah, I told you along with everyone. Anyway, so I just have to quickly send this note. And, Francis, why don't you tell us a little bit about what happened during the Phoenix Lights. You were involved in the City Council of Phoenix. The
right.
Go ahead.
I was the vice mayor at the time and knew nothing about any UFO or anything. And I was on my way to the weekly televised session, stopped outside of City Hall on my way in by a reporter named Cindy from Extra TV. And I've never seen her again, which is, I wish I could. And she asked me about, you know, if I knew about this object that flew over Arizona. And I said, what object? She says, well, there was something that flew over Arizona. It went from northwest to southeast, and it was really big. And I thought it was something that had just happened, like, you know, a day or so before that. And so I said, you know, when did this happen? And she said, well, March 13th. And I said, I hadn't heard anything about it at all. She said, could you ask if they could do an investigation in the city? So I said, sure. So I went in and I asked, there's a section of the city council meeting that is, it's called council request. And you can ask anything of any level of government, of anything that pertains to the city or the state. And so I asked if, I told them I was stopped by a reporter outside. And I said, apparently there was this object that flew over Arizona and on March 13th, and could we find out what it was? And my thought was, it's, you know, this is a safety issue. There's tall buildings, there's antennas, and, you know, if it flew low and slow and all of that, that was a safety issue. Well, when I asked that question, everything stopped. Everybody turned and looked at me like I had, you know, measles or something. And I looked around, and then somebody cracked a joke, and it went on. Now, the normal procedure would be to assign two staff members, and they get back to you within a week as to whatever they found out. And after, so nothing, right? And then after the council meeting, one of the deputy city managers came up to me, and he said, "You shouldn't have asked that question." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because the mayor didn't want anybody talking about this at all." And I said, "Well, he didn't tell me." And he said, "Well, yeah." And there was kind of a thing down at City Hall when the mayor would tell me something that was, I thought, wrong for my district or for the citizens of Phoenix in general. I'd say, "I'm sorry, I can't agree with that." And he'd say, "Well, you know, you have to agree with it. And you're not going to get whatever project I had pending in my district." And so I learned early on that when something like that happens, you go to the news media and you tell them. And so I did. And so eventually he would not tell me anything he didn't want out there in public. And he didn't tell me that. And so I asked the deputy city manager if he could find out why they didn't want to talk about this. It was, I didn't think UFO or anything, right? And so he didn't get back to me, but unfortunately, about a week later, he passed away. And so everybody kind of treated me with a lot of ridicule. I had the mayor's office posted a sign on my, we had all our pictures in the hallway, and he posted a sign on my picture that I came from the planet Xenon.
Oh.
And then him and his staff were handing out business cards that I was given one, sent one by somebody I knew in the mayor's office in an interoffice memo saying this is what he's handing out everywhere. And it was a business card said, "Frances Emma Barwood, speak into the tin foil and she will hear you." Oh. And he was handing these out at meetings and was like, "Wow, you know, it's that thou dost protest too much type thing." And then there was the cartoons in the paper and, you know, had a rocket going in one ear and out the other. And there was another one with Dr. Spock. And there was a third one that I forget what it was. But it was like, wow, they're, you know, they're really trying to make me out as some kind of a weird person. And all I'm trying to do is find out whatever this object was. Well, then I started getting videos of the news that night on television, all the news shows. And it was dropped off at my office, and it was signed Dr. X. And I thought, this is really strange, right? So we were watching them one night. I thought, well, okay, while I'm reading through my weekend big book to get done by Monday for the meeting on Tuesday, I'll start, you know, going through these videos. Well, I have to tell you then after that, on Friday, this was May 6th, was the meeting, May 6th, 97. And on Friday, the 9th, the reporter, Chris Fiscus, who had the city beat, came in and said, "You know, I'd like to interview you," and which happens occasionally. And I said, "Sure." And he said, "I want to talk to you about this object." And I said, "Do you know anything?" And we had a very interesting talk. First of all, he told me that the reporter was referred to the city council by the sheriff. And because he, you know, said this is not, you know, a sheriff's thing, this would be the city thing. And they tried to get every other one of the city council members to talk to her. Nobody would talk to her except me. And I didn't even know why I shouldn't have, right? Mm-hmm. So then he did this whole interview telling that his mother and sister saw this object that his mother said was not from this world. And he said, "If my mother said it, it's true." And he did this really good article which came out on May 10th in the Saturday paper. And the reason he did it that way was because he used the weekend editor, because the weekday editor would not let him do the story. So before I even saw the paper, I started getting phone calls at 7 o'clock in the morning that Saturday, the 10th, and they continued all day long until 11 o'clock at night. And then I took my phone off the hook, and my number was always published. So it's like, and nobody ever abused it. And so then Sunday, which was Mother's Day, I started getting calls 7:30 in the morning, all day long, Mother's Day till night. And I kept writing down everybody's name and number and what they saw. And then Monday I went into the office, and my voicemail in my office was full. So people were leaving messages on all the others, voicemails. And by law, they had to give them to me. So they did. And it was really astounding to me, because over that summer, which our break was the end of July till August and till the end of August, I started calling them back, and I called over 700 people. And it was really amazing, because everybody described the same thing. They said it was bigger than a football field, a mile wide. It was low. It was slow. It was obvious. There was absolutely no noise, no hum, no nothing. It had lights on it that were gaseous. They didn't shine down. They just kind of glowed. And they all said they were amazed, astounded, excited. Nobody said they were terrified. So if anybody was, they didn't call me. And it was, they said that it was something that they'll never forget. And it was like, wow. You know, that night on May 13th, I was down in the middle of the city in a meeting, and I was driving north on the same route that it was going south. And it took the most populated route from northwest Arizona, I think from Nevada, all the way through Arizona, the most populated route you could pick. So it wanted to be seen, whatever, you know, why. And at a time of night where everybody was out jogging, there was Little League playing, the people saw it, the parents saw it, the kids saw it, the people who, you know, coached saw it.
Wasn't there a comet, people watching a comet too at the time?
They're up here in Paradise Valley. There was a Hellbop party. Oh, and they were all outside, and they were, you know, watching Hellbop, and they were having a good time. And they all stopped because they sensed something over them.
Wow.
And they looked up, and they saw this object, and they watched it, and it went really, it was really low, they said, and very slow. They could see the shape. They described everything exactly the same, the kind of gaseous lights, traveling south. And they watched it until it was out of sight. It went back to their party and forgot all about it until the article came out. And that's what almost everybody I talked to said, that they just forgot about it and they couldn't understand it. And I'm thinking, how could you forget something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had an experience a year later, about a year and a half later, in November of 98. And we were listening to Frank Baranowski on the radio, local radio down there, The World Around Us. And somebody called in and said, did you see that thing in the eastern sky? And he said, no, but the security guards here did. And they said, I need to go out and take a look at it. So I said, we were in bed listening to him because he was on from 10 to midnight. And so my husband and I said, okay, let's go out. And, you know, so it was chilly, you know, cold. And we went out and looked east and kind of positioned it between the twigs on the tree, which were bare because it was cold, you know, no leaves, and stood there, and it did not move. It stayed there, and it was a huge glowing cylinder tipped to the left on the top, and we thought, that is really strange. So I called my friend who lives in Scottsdale, and I said, go out on your balcony and look to the east, and what do you see? And I woke her up, and she came back and she says, oh my God, what is that? And I said, I don't know. And she said, that's really amazing. Well, the next Thursday, we're driving down the street and going shopping, and we had the radio on, and it had an advertisement for Frank Baranowski's World Around Us. And I said to Mike, do you remember we saw something last Saturday night? in the east sky? And he goes, no. And I thought, oh, I must have dreamt it. And then I called my friend Patty and I said, Patty, do you remember us seeing anything? Did I call you last Saturday? And she goes, oh, my God, yeah. She forgot about it. Wow. Then my husband remembered. And so it's like the only thing I can think of is all these people whose memories were awakened, so to speak. Is it because it's outside our parameters of understanding? Was there something, you know, like don't pay attention to us or you know, we're not here to hurt you? I don't know. I just don't know. But it since it happened to me, then I understood for some reason all these people forgot about it until they saw that article. And then the videos I started getting from Dr. X was of all the news shows that night when they were talking about this object. And on one of them, Sergeant Mike Torres, who was the spokesperson for the Phoenix Police Department, was at the police department and they were, you know, live shot. And he said, we were overwhelmed with phone calls about whatever this was. And, you know, and then, and I said, what? Because I had just gotten the memo that said there were no phone calls to the city, to the police. And an official, you know, memo saying that. And I'm thinking, oh, wait a minute. He's saying they were overwhelmed, and this memo is saying they didn't get any phone calls. Something's really wrong here. So that's when I ended up finding out that Dr. X was actually Dr. Lynn Kitai, but she waited a little bit to tell who she was because, you know, she didn't want to have, I guess, ridicule. Mm-hmm. And so she got all her ducks in a row and came out that that's who it was. And I said, you know, you look at all the people involved in this, all the people that it has changed their lives. At first, I thought it was a military thing, but we know a couple of pilots that would not talk about it until they retired. And they said, that is nothing from this earth. Wow. And I do have faith in these people to be very aware. And the same with the governor. You know, I've known Fife and Ann Symington for a long time. Great. Fife is extremely intelligent. And I had referred people to him. And then that July, he bucked the federal government because they were going to close down the Grand Canyon. And he said, it will destroy all the businesses in the Grand Canyon. I'll send the National Guard down there. And they told him he couldn't do it, and he was going to do it anyway. And as it turned out, they then backed off of closing the Grand Canyon. But then he was doing the Esplanade in Central Phoenix, and they said that he fudged the figures on his application. And it was like, what? You know, he's a multimillionaire. And it's like, something's wrong here. So we all figured, well, that's their retribution against him. Well, at the time that all this was going on with the Phoenix Lights, he was in court fighting what they were doing to him. And they were going to put him in prison for, you know, fraud and all this kind of stuff. And it was, I really do think that it was total intimidation to show others don't buck the federal government. But while he was in court, they had a break, and he went to a Child Help USA luncheon, and they had reporters there. And then one reporter said to him, what are you going to do about this object that went over Arizona they're calling the Phoenix Lights or something? He said something like that. And he said, well, we're going to investigate whatever it is. He said, you know, this is something that infected a lot of people, and we're going to investigate. Well, when he got back to court, the people who were there watching this trial said that he was called into the judge's chambers and he never came out. And in the meantime, they announced that he was going to do an emergency press conference at 5:00. And so we saw that and I thought, oh, something must have happened in the state, you know, so because emergency is emergency, right? And he held that press conference. And out walks his chief of staff in this, the E.T. costume. And it was like, what? And first of all, I know Fife, and I'll be the first one to tell you, he does not have a sense of humor. There's no way that he planned that in a million years. You could tell him a joke and a bunch of people standing around laughing, and he wouldn't get it. So, you know, I knew right then and there something was really wrong.
Wow.
And my theory right at that point was, I bet they're going to drop the Chargers because they made him do this. And sure enough, they dropped the Chargers. I haven't been able to talk to Fife. but I totally understand what he did. You know, here he had a wife and six kids at home, and the federal government going to put him in prison for trumped up charges that are nonsense. And, you know, what do you do against the federal government? So they gave him, you do this, we drop the charges. They did, he did. And then after he was out of office, then he could say, you know, what he saw. And I really sympathize with him, because I would think that he held that in knowing he could not talk about it at all at that time.
Wow.
And it must have been hard.
Really? Well, that's an aspect of that story that I never heard. You know, I remember someone mentioned something about him possibly having a fraud charge, and they only said that it was a skeptic that was on my show in the past. I think it was Michael Shermer. The only reason that he mentioned that at all was that he was kind of downgrading Fife Symington's testimony that he actually saw that thing go over him in the park. He was saying, why would you trust him? You know, he had a fraud charge against him. So, you know, I mean, it's just unbelievable, convoluted.
Well, and you have to look at why did he have that and what he did prior to that. And, you know, it's because I knew the whole, you know, chain of events. And I know that Fife Symington is a very, how can I put this? He wouldn't do something that would be against his own integrity. So, you know, it got really strange with the federal government with the whole thing, because, you know, how do you fight the federal government?
Right.
You know, they come down on you. What do you do? It's, you know, very few lawyers will take on the federal government. And now, of course, this is my theory of what happened, because I saw it every step of the way. And I know, you know, that there was no way in the world that he planned that press conference, you know, as stupid as it was. There was no way. So that's my theory of what happened. I tried once to talk to Fife, and he was really embarrassed and kind of exited himself, because he didn't want to talk about it, and which was odd in itself, because, you know, I've known him for a long time. And you think of all this stuff and you think, well, what? It's, again, the thou dost protest too much theory. All the people I talked to, well, and then, you know, there's Richard Curtis. And Richard Curtis, my phone number, always in the phone book. And I get this call one day in July. And he said, I got some video of that object. And he said, I have professional CB equipment and professional video equipment. I'm a disabled vet, and that's my hobbies. And he said, I was listening to the truckers driving south on I-17, and they were talking about this humongous object they were following, and that it was going so slow and low, and it was something they've never seen before. And he said, so I decided to go up on the roof and videotape it as it would be coming down. And so he said, I got one videotape and it ran out. So I put another videotape in there. And he said, the reflection from the streetlights in Phoenix showed this very dull kind of gunmetal color object with these gaseous lights. And it was just moving so low and slow. He says, I really got a good picture of it. And I said, wow, it's amazing. And he said, would you want to see it? And I said, yeah. And I said, can you make a copy and get it over to my office? So got busy with, you know, city stuff and everything. And I didn't even ask, you know, I figured they'd tell me when they got it. And then about 2 weeks later, he calls me again and he said, well, what did you think of the video? And I said, I didn't get the video. And he goes, well, the two men came from your office. And I said, I don't have men in my office. I have women. And he said, well, they came here and they got it. And he said, they came to my door and asked for the tape. And I asked if they were from Barwood's office. They said yes. And I handed them the tape. And he said, they asked me if I made copies and I didn't make copies yet. And they said, oh, we'll just get copies to you. And they left. And I'm thinking, oh, this is baloney. This guy just, you know, took me down the garden path. Well, then one of the investigators from the Village Labs who did spectrogram on the lighting and stuff, he went over there to check this out. And he went into the lobby and he talked to the manager and the minister who counsels with the residents there. They were in the lobby. And he you know, told them about what had happened. And he said, you know, do you know anything about this? And he goes, well, the weirdest thing, they saw this car pull up and it was a black car with black windows. These two guys got out, three-piece suits and hats, and they came in and asked if we could tell them where Richard Curtis's apartment was. So we told them where it was, and they went up there. And they said that, you know, it was so odd that they remembered it. And it was like, holy cow, you know, they verified what Richard Curtis said. Well, then Richard Curtis was on television and they had asked him about all of this and he told them the whole story. And then right after that, he had a change of medication and the other resident said he got really sick and they came and took him away and nobody ever saw him again.
Unreal. It almost sounds, someone had mentioned Men in Black. It almost sounds like that. That type of situation, the men in the suits and the blacked out windows. Yeah, that's weird.
And it was 110 degrees that day, and that's why they thought it was so odd that these guys were in three-piece suits, black suits, with black hats. And they just thought it's so odd that they were dressed what they would consider extremely warm. And, you know, just the whole thing was just really strange. And so, you know, apparently these videos that were really very good defined videos of this object were gone. Now, there was one television station just recently said, oh, they were flares, and that's all that was. And, well, flares don't go, you know, 400 miles horizontally. And no smoke, and, you know, you look at the whole thing. So I've changed my opinion, and in the Bible where it says, in my Father's house there's many mansions, the original text says, in my Father's cosmos there's many worlds. And I guess they just didn't want anybody to know that. I don't know. But, you know, I'm a Christian, you know, it's, to me, it's biblical. And why not? If God created the universe, he created the universe. Why do we think we're the only ones?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's definitely the issue that a lot of people, you know, in science even, just, I think there's fear issues somehow. There's a great old saying that if we're alone or if we're not alone, both ways are frightening, you know?
You know, the other part of it is, if we're the best there is, oh my God.
Yeah.
You know, so
I hope it's not.
Been...
So this, when you were talking to all these 700 people and you were trying to get some action, what other pushback did you get?
Well, let me go back to the Richard Curtis thing. I didn't know how these people would know who I talked to, because I didn't tell anybody. And so we had a friend who's a private investigator. And I said, you know, the only thing I can think of is my phone is tapped. So he had a friend who can check out the lines. He worked for the phone company, and he checked out our lines out and inside. Then he went outside. Then he went along the whole line things to that, whatever that is out there. And he would not come back in the house. And he knocked on the door and he said, I did not come here. And he said, I want to tell you that you have a tap on your line that goes to the central office. It is always government. And he said, it's always federal government. And he said, you don't know me, never saw me. And he left. So he was really frightened what he found. And I'm thinking, wow, they're listening to everybody I talk to. Isn't that really interesting? So then I'm thinking, okay, so all these people, these over 700 people that I talked to, and the government or nobody ever questioned any of them, which I thought was also really odd, because if they're not questioning anybody, they already know.
Mm.
They just don't want us to know, which is interesting. Now, you know, with this whole thing, it's like, I don't think there's anything to be afraid, because, you know, if we go to the nearest planet, they said it's 40 light years away. Well, if they can manage to come here to observe us and say, oh, they're still really primitive, and take off and go back again, or examine people like they did with Travis Walton, they're way advanced. And, you know, we're thinking of our technology, which it would take 40 light years to get to a nearest kind of habitable planet. Well, that's not their technology. They've probably found something better. I mean, who would have thought I'd be talking to you on a cell phone that I could carry with me and, you know, have things on the internet and everything is in cyberspace. Who'd have thought I learned on a manual typewriter. You know, not in a million years would I have thought this.
Yeah, I mean, so much has happened in such a short time. And can you imagine what 1,000 years from now will be like? You know, we have some questions that came in for, you know, basically anyone, Lynn or anyone else on the forum. And this one I thought was pretty good. How do you respond to people that say that the Phoenix Lights have long ago been debunked as nothing more than military flares?
Well, they did a comparison, and I thought it was hysterically funny. They did it on television. They had a split screen. One half was the video that Dr. Lynn Kitai took. The other half was the flares that they set off in a line. Well, the video that Dr. Lynn took was moving very slowly horizontally. These flares were in all different speeds of dropping. They were flaring. They had smoke. They were uneven. Nothing in a line at all. And they said, "Oh, that looks just like that." And I'm thinking, really? Are they looking at what I'm looking at? So, yeah, no, it was not flares. And again, you know, flares can't travel over 400 miles horizontally and stay in a perfect line.
Yeah. Okay, another thing is when you were trying to figure out what was going on, how much of the groundwork did you do? Did you try to contact places like NORAD or any other places, you know, to find out what they had for radar or anything like that?
Others have done that, and they denied anything. And I sent a letter to Senator McCain, and he sent that to Lansford Trapp, who was the director of the Armed Services. And that went nowhere, and he just said I was a constituent. He didn't say I was, you know, the vice mayor of City Phoenix or anything. And so then I waited a while. I got no response. I sent another letter saying, you know, you promised you were going to investigate. He did on television. He said he would investigate. Never did anything. And which is typical for him anyway. But so I sent another letter and I said, you said you were going to investigate and I would like you to investigate. Signed it as the vice mayor of the City of Phoenix and all of that. Nothing. So I called the office and they said at first they didn't know about this letter. So then I had my assistant call the office and they said, oh, yeah, he did do a letter or he sent the letter she sent. And he sent it to the National Archives. And I thought, well, that's known as the big, you know, trash can, big bitter trash can in the government. Mm-hmm. So then I had my assistant call the National Archives. And they said, after much time, yes, they did get my letter sent to them by Senator McCain's office. And all they do is file. And she said, could you send me a letter saying that that's what you got? And she said, we don't do that. So she said, can you just write it down on a paper and fax it to my office when we had faxes? And so she did that. She just said that they had received my letter from Senator McCain's office and that they put it in the archives. And that was that.
Wow. Now, didn't Senator Kane do some type of, didn't he talk about this a little bit, or was that another situation?
That was prior. No, that was prior.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was, around the same time that the governor said, we're going to do an investigation. There were people who asked him, oh, yeah, I'm going to check into that. Well, he never did. Ever did.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were speaking to these 700 witnesses, how demanding were some of them as far as, like, I need to know what this is? Or did they just, was it more curiosity? Or did people get pushy about it?
Well, I'll tell you, none of them were pushy, rude, anything. And I'll tell you, there were two people that called me. One is a very famous entertainer, and one was said he was in a large company in Phoenix and couldn't tell me his name. Well, the first one told me who he was and said, I do not want you to tell because I don't know how people would react to this, but I wanted you to know I saw this and it was the most incredible thing I've seen in my life and I'll never forget it. And he is still around and I won't tell who he is. And then the other person, he did not want to tell me his name. And I said, well, then I'm sorry, but, I'm not going to listen to anything you say because anybody could be calling me. So he finally made me swear I would never tell. I said, listen, I've held secrets so long in my life that I forgot what they were. So not to worry. And so he gave me his name and his company. And he said, I make six figures and I can't lose my job. And I said, not to worry. The next day, I called that company. I asked for this person who was vice president of the company, got him. He answered the phone because I told who I was. And I said, I'm just checking to see that was really you or it was somebody pretending to be you. Hmm. And I said, I'll never tell. And I never did. And I never will. I haven't even told my husband. I haven't told my kids, nobody. And the thing is, they just wanted me to know what they saw. They actually really kind of risked everything, but they had to unload what they saw. And
wow.
Everybody that I talked to just wanted me to know what they saw. And they all described the same thing. There was one kid that came out and said that he was on a telescope that night and saw these six planes in formation. Well, that's the one that they gave publicity to. But here's the thing. Planes don't fly in formation at night in the city. It's like, do not do that ever. And so, but that's what they wanted somebody to say. I don't know, how that came about or anything. But when you've got over 700 people that I talked to, some of them were like the people that were at the Halebop party. That was 27 people there. And there were people that were out the Little League games and so everybody was with other people. And so we figured out, by the amount of people they were around that saw it and people on the freeway that, stopped their cars and everybody got out of their cars. And we figured it's probably around 10,000 people here or there. And
you think
that object did the most populated pathway. And here I was going north when it was going south, and I never looked up. And they all described the same thing.
Wow. Dr. Lynn is going to be calling in 5 minutes. And the way this Skype is set up right now, I can't have two people on. For some reason, it's not letting me join people. So when she calls, I'm going to have to say, that was about 4 minutes from now, when she calls, I'm going to have to say goodbye. I wish I could have you on for the whole show. It's been really, really interesting. Now, you mentioned that that all the people you spoke with basically said they saw the same thing. There are some stories that there were different type of vehicles spotted. And you know, sort of like the boomerang one, and then a solid object all the way through. Did people have those two variances?
No, they may have been the same. They may have seen something different, but the ones I talked to, it was all the boomerang shape. Mm-hmm. It was low. It was slow. It was obvious. It was completely silent. There was absolutely no noise. And the other amazing thing, with all the people they were with, they all stood in total silence watching this thing. Nobody was, you know, looking or talking or anything. Some of them, you know, were pretty excited and did. But for the most part, they just stood there in awe. And, you know, I wish I would have seen it, but I have no doubt that what they saw was something very real. There may have been others, they said, other, and they could have been other crafts, because who knows if it was just one. So many people saw. It's just, you can't get 10 people to agree on the same thing. And here, you know, all these people described exactly the same thing.
Right. Wow. Yeah, and the other variances, I've heard some people say a football field, some people say a mile. I remember there was one of the witnesses that mm-hmm. said it was from peak to peak on these two mountains. So it was like a mm-hmm. mile apart. So whatever it was huge.
It was huge.
Yeah.
And, you know, we couldn't get anything like that up in the air. And
not yet. Not that we know of, anyway. Yeah.
That we know, yeah. But, you know, here it is. It's been seen all over the world, you know, but other countries are much more open about it. And they just say, oh, yeah, well, that's probably something from another world. And it's like no biggie to them.
Yeah.
Why is it such a biggie to us? And you look at the Vatican. They put this humongous telescope down on Mount Lemmon. And, you know, Father Malachi said the reason is because the Vatican wants to be able to know when they come.
Oh, really? I've heard there's one of the astronomers that does talk about they think that there is life, which I think that is pretty open-minded, you know, compared to, you know, times past.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Just to let you know, I'm probably going to have to interrupt you any second now.
Okay.
I don't know if you'd ever want to come back on again. This is, you know, I just feel like we haven't got too far in the conversation. And let me just, while we have a minute here, what has happened since with you? Has that ever haunted you? Well, she's calling now, so I'm going to have to say goodnight. So thanks so much.
If you want to call me back later, that's fine.
Okay.
Take care.
All right. You take care.
Thanks.
All right. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This must be Dr. Lynn, I presume. Hello? Lynn, can you hear me? I can't hear you, Lynn. Let's see. Why don't you try a call again? I don't have any audio. All right, so hang in, everyone. She should be calling right back. If not, we'll call our... Here she is. Let's try it. Lynn, can you hear me?
Yeah, hi. I've been trying to get...
Yeah, there you are. How are you?
I am so sorry. I didn't realize it. You know, if you do STARTE 2, it goes through. You know that, right?
I do. I'm going to write that down. No, I did not know
yes.
that. STAR 82.
STAR 82. Yep.
Because this is not the first time it's happened. It's happened in a couple of other shows. So, yes, I will.
Yeah, I am so sorry. Yeah, if I had known you couldn't get through, I would have unblocked it or whatever. We would have used Skype. But I can stay with you until, you know, quarter to seven or seven, if you like.
Well, unfortunately, I can't take multi people at the same time for some reason. Skype's not helping me do that tonight. But I can.
Okay.
I think about a half hour, and then I'm going to speak with Steve after
That's
that.
Great.
So.
Okay, and you talked to Fran.
Yes, we had a wonderful conversation. Yes.
Oh, good, good. Yes. Oh, I'm so glad. You're going to have a great show here.
I know. I think so.
No, so, I'm so glad I could help out that way. And I'm so sorry about the mix-up. I mean, I was on the other radio program, and it was like 5:15, and I told them that any second you were going to call. And then I thought, my God, you know, I said, I got to go. Then I saw your email. I was like, oh, no, you know, now what do we do? And I got the call from Steve. So anyway, we're ready to go, and I'll get in as much as I can.
Sure.
You know, so, I don't want to talk too fast, but there's a lot going on. And, you know, I want to talk about Steve, too, a little bit at the end.
Yeah. So let's talk about the 20th anniversary. What
right.
What has that kind of, you know, stirred up out there in the Has there been a lot of recognition?
Are we online now?
Oh, yeah, we're live, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yes, we're live, yep.
People just heard our conversation.
Yeah, that's fine, yeah.
Anyway, boy, I'll tell you, it has been such a whirlwind. I mean, that's why these radio programs have been back-to-back, and it's just such a thrill to be able to share the information with so many people out there. The 20th anniversary, I mean, it's really... really significant because the Phoenix Lights, and mind you, when I came forward after 7 years of anonymity without having any knowledge or interest in the topic before my husband, who's also a physician, both of us had a sighting very close to our home in 95, 2 years before the mass sighting. I caught 35-millimeter photographs of these orbs, these oval orbs in a pyramid formation, literally and figuratively right outside our bedroom window. Wondered for 2 years, because I didn't even know who to show the pictures to, what this advanced technology was right outside our window. And here we do it 2 years later, and this is significant data. If anybody is near a computer or even later can go on the Phoenix Lights Network website, which, by the way, Steve Lance, who's going to be coming on shortly, is my film collaborator and also webmaster. He is just brilliant, and it's such an amazing, amazing, jam-packed website filled with, you know, so many wonderful things, including the photographs, the photo page, the Gap page, which we'll get to in a second, Geospatial Animation Project, and we just revamped and updated the news page, which is just packed with wonderful media reports and articles. Anyway, 2 months before the mass sighting, if you go on the photo page, you'll see the close sighting photographs, which have been analyzed and authenticated by all my 35-millimeter. I'm the only one with 35-millimeter by university and military optical physicists. And actually, there's a story behind the close sighting, which I, if we have time, we'll get to, because they were analyzed by Navy optical physicist Dr. Bruce McAbee, who presented the case in 1999 at the MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, International Symposium in Washington, D.C., and his conclusion was pretty riveting, I have to say, and I just shared it for the first time in the last edition of the book, 2010, but I share even more in the newest edition that I've never shared before, The Phoenix Lights, A Skeptic's Discovery That We Are Not Alone for the 20th Anniversary. But anyway, 2 months before the mass sighting, I caught the same exact mile-wide phenomena of equidistant lights that I would also capture on video during the mass sighting, the three endpoints of a giant V or triangle in the same exact location. And I called around. It was so unnerving not having an explanation for 95 that I called around and found air traffic controllers at Sky Harbor International Airport who saw the same thing at the same time. And they were very forthcoming initially, hovering at about 1,000 feet altitude over Class B restricted airspace. There's a 30-mile radius around the center of the airport. Anyone that comes into that airspace, especially at 1,000 feet altitude, and these were only 5 miles away, must call the tower, and no one did. So they looked on radar, did not show up on radar, took their binoculars to look. And in their own words, they described 6 points of light, totally equidistant from each other, massive span over a mile wide, that seemed to be attached to something, which you will hear again 2 months later during the mass sighting by thousands of people. but they couldn't quite see what it was attached to, or there was a force field in between the lights holding them in rock-solid formation. And one of them was a meteorologist and said that the whole thing turned as a unit against the wind. And this is while I'm photographing them. The pictures are right there. And then elevated slowly and in synchrony moved behind South Mountain, which is just south of the airport. So I said, so what were they? And there was silence. And then one of the air traffic controllers said, beats me. I said, you're air traffic controllers. You're supposed to know what's in our airspace, and you didn't know what they were. They ruled out every logical, conventional explanation imaginable, from flares to conventional aircraft to Chinese lanterns, even skydivers holding lights, okay? And we kept in contact. I continued photographing up and including up to and including March 13th, 1997. And anyone out there that's not familiar with what has become worldwide the most witnessed, most documented, and most important anomalous aerial phenomena sighting in modern history. Thousands of people were outside purposely looking up at the clear sky for a glimpse of the Hale-Bopp comet, when they also caught a glimpse of these mile to 2 mile wide and even larger. The head of the National UFO Reporting Center, Peter Davenport, and I just did a big weekend, Phoenix Lights weekend celebration in Oregon, and he said to me, you know, he got reports, credible reports, that one of the craft, because there's so much missing disinformation out there, was 8 miles wide. I mean, it's just inconceivable. But at any rate, the bottom line, the technology was incredible, and it wasn't just one or two events. And that was another reason I had to come forward after 7 years of anonymity and pushing my medical career aside to try to find a logical source and meaning once thousands of people saw what I had been seeing, because there is so much more to this story. And you know, you'll hear it was one event or two events, and it was only for a couple hours. Well, that was the couple hours is when the majority of people were outside looking up at the sky. But actually, the mass sighting started not only days before, and there were people that were documenting them like I was. Steve Blonder, in fact, was seeing them and documenting them on film and called MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, up to his balcony the night of March 13th, a little coincidentally, they were happened to be standing there, and here this giant delta shaped of five lights appears, and he caught one of the videos as well before 10 o'clock, as I did before 10 o'clock, and the boomerang videos were shot after 10 o'clock. But at any rate, we'll get to that in a minute, because that's really important data too. But meanwhile, people were seeing these at least mile to 2 mile wide, either lights that seemed to be attached to something or actual craft, very slowly gliding about 30 miles an hour, rooftop level. Some people said they were so close it could throw a rock at it. Others saw it take off at blink speed without even dispersing the air. And what was so eerie to everyone was that it was totally silent. Some people saw these orbs detach from the main object, go out into the environment, and then redock with it. And again, it wasn't just one or two events. The mass sighting on March 13 started at 3 p.m. in the afternoon. There were daylight sightings of these phenomena. 5 o'clock hour, they were seen by Native Americans in New Mexico. 7 o'clock hour in California. Actually, the 11 o'clock hour, one of these craft covered Las Vegas, and two commercial airlines saw this. A pilot got in touch with me a few years later, and boy, her story was amazing. What happened to her? I get into that in the book when she tried to report it. And then at 3 a.m. the following morning, and this was continuing. I mean, people were still seeing these gigantic V-shape or delta shape or triangle shape or boomerang shape. There were 10 different crafts. Now, if you go on the GAP page, Geospatial Animation Project page, and I'm trying to really get a lot in for you before 6:30, you will see a 12-year compilation of thousands of reports to the National UFO Reporting Center in Seattle, Washington, to Arizona MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, to then Councilwoman, and she was a really shining star, that Councilwoman Vice Mayor Frances Barwood, who you just spoke with, right? Yes,
yeah.
You just spoke with her. She was amazing. I mean, she really helped me come at least get a little step forward in this whole process because she was so brave. And she bravely asked for, you know, an investigation in May and was just plastered by the media. It wasn't pretty in those days when people came forward. I was very happy to stay anonymous. But anyway, she had over 1,000 reports, as well as Village Labs, which is the clearinghouse here. It was a computer lab that also studied UFO sightings. So we're talking thousands of reports over 12 years, and two or more people had to see the same craft to be included in the study. And if you look at the GAP page, Geospatial Animation Project, not only will you see illustrations, but you'll also see animations. And by the way, we also, just this past weekend, came out with the Phoenix Lights UFO and Crop Circles coloring book, graphic novel, The Adventures of Sue F.O., Field Observer, and Hugh, H-U-G-H, U-F-O. It is incredible. I've been working on a curriculum for 5 years and wanted to get something out that was really entertaining and fun and informative for all ages. There's games in there. There's over 80 crop circles to draw. The 10 different craft, and they were very different, okay? The 10 different craft are also there with a picture of where they were seen. It's in the coloring book. It's really fun, and that's offered at on Amazon, as is the book and the updated documentary, which I'll get to in a second, which Steve Lance, who you'll be meeting with, was my collaborator. But at any rate, here, those 10 different craft. Now, whether it was one craft that could morph into looking different, or the perspective from where the person was standing, or actual craft, actual parade. And that was the conclusion that the investigators, after 12 years of studying this data, concluded, because there were many things happening at the same time in different areas, as I mentioned, even outside the state of Arizona. But we're talking orb formations as well as different-looking craft, and some of them split in two. One of the crafts split in two and shot straight up. Another one, which blew me away, I have to tell you, Martin, I had been doing so much research. 1,000 of people saw what I had been seeing. And I realized that this not only was happening worldwide and that other countries were much more open to these being otherworldly, but also that it's been happening since human documentation began. And interestingly, 1 month before our mass sighting, there was another mass sighting in St. Petersburg, Russia. And a few people, a few civilians, caught video, and actually air traffic controllers also saw these phenomena, and there were different ones as well there too, over their tarmac. And when you look at those videos, one of them just blew me away because it was exactly, and we've had that on our last cover of our documentary, The Phoenix Lights Beyond Top Secret. Each light was actually three lights. And in St. Petersburg, they took video in St. Petersburg, Russia, of the same exact thing 1 month before our mass sighting. So, which is really, really interesting. So anyway, if you take a look at the GAP page, you'll see there were 10 different crafts. So there was a lot going on. And here, as you watch the story unfold, which is in and of itself really poignant, because there was no investigation. There was no explanation for months. It was just bizarre. I mean, here, even as a public safety issue, and when thousands of people see something, the other thing that I wanted to say before we get on to how the story unfolded is that there has not been one, and this is really important to know too, besides the nuts and bolts technology, and that we haven't seen anything remotely close to these phenomena for 20 years, and now with the precarious nature of the world, you would think we would have seen this technology if we had it. Not only that, but the way it affected people in real time and in long term is really important. The movie Independence Day was real popular about 6 months before the mass sighting, and we address this in the documentary. I mean, we're so inundated with threat, 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 and harm, harm, harm. Dr. Gary Schwartz, who is the head of the Consciousness Study Department at the University of Arizona, gives a very powerful statement when he says, you know, if you're kind of prodded with the scenario that something is going to be frightening, or threatening, how do you think you're going to feel if you see something that is that massive? And actually, children were usually the first ones to see these phenomena coming towards them, and they were jumping up and down, Independence Day, Independence Day. But as it got closer, a calmness took over everyone, adults and children as well, a connectiveness to the phenomena that when it passed, the children wanted to run after it or get their parents to get in the car and drive after it, and some did, actually. And just in real time, it affected people at such a deep level. People were in awe, were just in joy and in wonder. And some people, and quite a number, by the way, had got telepathic messages. We have one story in the book about a psychiatrist and his family that were coming up to Phoenix from Tucson. And they were all in the car, and one of these mile-wide craft was right above them for minutes. And they said that the wings were on each side of the big highway, the I-10 highway, and nobody said a word. And this wasn't uncommon, by the way. Never said a word. And months later, they saw something on television, and suddenly it just hit them, and they looked at each other and said, "We saw that." And the wife actually got a telepathic message not to worry. They weren't here to harm us. I mean, it's just amazing when you hear these stories. In fact, on the Phoenix Lights Network website, there is a share page. And that was the other reason that I had to come forward. Not only as a scientist, as an experiencer up close and personal, as an educator for over 40 years on vital health issues, and geez, how could I not address this vital issue? But also as a physician, to let people know that they're not crazy, even though most anomalies can be explained. Only a small percentage cannot. And just because we don't have the technology yet to definitively define what these things are, it doesn't mean they're not real. Mm. We may just be looking on the AM dial for an FM frequency. So I urge people, because when somebody has a paranormal experience, it's real to them. And if you don't share it, it festers. It's not healthy. And that was one of the other reasons I wanted to come forward after 7 years, was to let people know there's somebody they can at least message on Facebook, Phoenix Lights Network Facebook page, or through the website. We have a share page that is pretty amazing when you hear it from the people themselves. And I just got an email a few days ago from a fellow who was 17 when he saw, or 16 when he saw the mass sighting, and it took 17 years for him to actually recall it. When he saw something on television, it was like a floodgate open for him, and he got a telepathic message as well. So I invite people to take a look at the share page and read his story. It's pretty amazing. So anyway, the bottom line is that it really affected people in real time and long term.
What about you?
Now,
you said you remained anonymous for 7 years, and then you finally admitted, you finally came forward. What did that change in your life? I mean, did you have a practice, or were you working somewhere?
Yeah, that's a good question, Martin. Actually, I went back to work, and this isn't about me, by the way. This is about the data. But if I can be a credible voice, and ultimately, after much soul-searching, because I did not want to come forward, especially when I saw what happened to people like Francis and other people, it was very precarious to come forward, to say the least. But again, as a scientist, I did my homework. I really tried to do my homework and ended up with a 750-page journal. I mean, meticulously every day, of witness reports, of talking to the military, and that's a whole other story, of media reports, which are so interesting, that I lay out in the book as well, and how it affected people at such a deep level. I mean, that doesn't happen with balloons and helicopters and holograms or whatever. I mean, it really affected people at a deep level. So anyway, once I had that 750-page journal, I actually had to go back to work to help put our younger son who, through medical school. He's a neurologist now, and he actually had a couple sightings with us. He's in the documentary. And while I was chief clinical consultant of the imaging and wellness department at the Arizona Heart Institute, wonderful job. It was fabulous, and nobody knew. Nobody knew there what I was doing. And, you know, in my free time, I was editing down the book to the best, most credible data that I had found. plus I kept documenting these things on film and going to great lengths to have my 35 millimeter authenticated, and for somebody to tell me what they were, and to date, nobody can. And by the way, there hasn't been one report of harm, threat, or abduction associated with the Phoenix Lights. I want to get that in because that's really important, especially with a couple movies out there that, you know, really are scary horror films that have nothing to do with what really happened here, because it was a totally benevolent, non-threatening scenario. But can't talk for other things, but I can about the Phoenix Lights. Anyway, with all these things that I had gathered, really, in good conscience, Martin, I could not stick it in a drawer. And ultimately, I came forward, and I can't tell you. I mean, I really tried to do the homework for everybody and condense the 750 pages into the 250 pages, and now it's going, it just went into its third print, of the best, most credible data that I had found those 7 years, and it has evolved ever since. But I couldn't believe that the doctors and nurses, they, as soon as they found out, and they would pull me aside and tell me their stories. I mean, they were thrilled that somebody of credence had come forward. And again, if I can be a credible voice so people actually look at the data, then I've done my job. And I've been very, very fortunate. I mean, people that actually look at it, I know when somebody, you know, blows it off as flares or starts talking about, you know, I mean, I know that they haven't looked at the data. I mean, right. It's as simple as that, which is a choice.
Yeah, there's a question I'd like to ask, because I was interested in asking you this, if it's the one I'm thinking of. Have you ever spoken with Trigg Johnston?
Yes, I did. He's in the book. I did talk to Trigg Johnston, and he was very impressive as a pilot. And yes, I mean, he, you know, he, among so many other pilots, and we have a wonderful pilot in a documentary who saw, you know, one of these craft right over him and looked into what he would call a canister of swimming light. It did not reflect down. It was so unusual and awe producing that, you know, I mean, you know, pilots, military, even police. We have a 911 police operator in the documentary who came up to me at one of the lectures and said, you know, I know the police said that they only got a few calls. She said, but I just retired and I was on that night and we got hundreds of calls. And the police helicopters were out there, you know, investigating it, as were military jets. I mean, there was a call at 3 a.m. the next morning from an alleged crewman from Luke Air Force Base. And he called the National UFO Reporting Center in very, very great detail and very professional. We have some of that recording in the documentary to report that military jets were sent out from Luke Air Force Base to intercept, get gun camera film, which we heard that they did, of one of these mile-wide craft right over central Phoenix. And as it got close, I mean, this is an amazing story, and there were civilians that saw this too happening, by the way, with the jets with their afterburners. As they approached, the light started to dim, and then the craft just blinked out and disappeared. And the crewman said he was one of the people to help one of the pilots out of his craft because he was so shaken up by it. Right. And actually, the last report that I have is at 5:30 the next morning. So we're talking about 3 p.m. in the afternoon all the way. I mean, all this activity. And, of course, the bulk of reports came in between 8 and 10 because that's when people were awake and outside looking up at the sky at the Hale-Bopp Comet. But it continued. At 5:30, there was a crew, a Boeing crew that was coming into work at Sky Harbor International Airport, and one of them shared with me confidentially that they all saw one of the mile-wide craft right over their tarmac. So there was so much going on March 13th, and then not to have an investigation or explanation when you see how the story unfolded, which is so interesting. Barr was asking for one and getting plastered by the media, and then suddenly, June 18th, front page USA Today article came out, opening our sighting to international scrutiny. Overnight, it went viral, and we didn't have social media at the time. In fact, we only had the clunky phones. People ask all the time, why isn't there more pictures? Well, people that tried to take pictures, and I'm trying to get everything in here for you, Martin, because there's so much detail, but that's one of the questions that keeps coming up, so I just want to mention it, that the craft were so dark and so black that the pictures did not turn out. I mean, it was so big they blocked out the stars. Only the handful of video which is really important because, and mine is one of the signature videos, actually the only one that was confirmed as true unknowns, because the air traffic controller saw the same thing that I was filming over Class B restricted airspace during the mass sighting. But besides that, that was the only hard evidence. And it was interesting because after the USA Today article came out, and, you know, we were really deluged by media from all over the world. And once they started talking to the witnesses, their reports were so detailed and so heartfelt that they, too, were saying, why isn't there an investigation? Why isn't there an explanation? The very next day, and I'm just giving you the highlights here. There's so much more. But the very next day, our former Governor Symington called a press conference to reveal the culprit. After months of nothing, suddenly he was going to reveal the culprit of the lights over Phoenix. And people took it seriously. I was thrilled. I was looking for any logical explanation. And he comes marching out, one of his aides, with a giant alien head costume and making a mockery of it. I mean, it really was disturbing, disconcerting for especially parents that were with kids. And we all took, I mean, everybody was saying this is not a joke. I mean, it was really disconcerting that he did that. What's interesting is that a month later, and I called every military base, and some of the conversations are quite comical that I share in my book. They were just as interested as we were in finding out what was going on. And I get a call from one of the heads of PR at the Air National Guard, and she says, oh, Dr. Lynn, I think we know what those lights were back in March. And I was thrilled. I said, you do? I said, well, you know, she said, do you believe that nobody ever looked at the log for visiting Air National Guard? And the Maryland Air National Guard was sending off flares, military LUTU illumination flares, in Operation Snowbird, which I later found out, Martin, means in military terms, diversionary tactical maneuvers. And, you know, it's been a diversion ever since, whether they did it or not. And I have to say, there hasn't been one witness that has come forward that I'm aware of that actually saw flares, but they may have sent them off to divert attention at some point. But
be that I wondered today, about that, if that was like, you know, sort of a cover-up type of thing. There's a question.
Can I just finish this one thought? Because it's really important.
Yeah.
Because I said to her, I said, well, when was the Maryland Air National Guard in town? And she said, March 1st to the 15th. I said, were they in town in January? She said, oh, no. I said, are you sure? She said, absolutely not. I said, well, I said, you know, I have 35 millimeter of the same exact phenomena in the same exact location confirmed by air traffic controllers, both in January and the morning after the mass sighting, as hovering 1,000 feet altitude over Class B restricted airspace. And she says, you never told me that. And then I said, and you're trying to tell me, and I, again, try to educate myself to anything logical, that flares that cannot keep a formation, that drift and drop with the wind haphazardly, have huge smoke trails that are illuminated by the flare itself and illuminate the area around it. Again, not one person would give those characteristics for the true unknowns. Traverse the entire state in a rock-solid, equidistantly spaced, mile-wide V formation for hours. And she says, I have a call coming in. I'll have to call you back. And I'm still waiting, Martin, 20 years later. But that's not the end of the story. Real quickly, I'm just going to tell you, months passed, and 3 years later, and that really put a lid on it once they came out with the flare thing, which was so frustrating. That was another reason I had to come forward, because that was the official explanation that was accepted when I came forward in 2004, and we've come a long way in that many years. But 3 years later, Frances Barwood ran for Secretary of State, bless her, on a platform to get answers for the Phoenix Lights. And she wanted a reenactment. She was asking for a reenactment. I don't know if you talked about it, but if you go to the news page, which is packed with information on the Phoenix Lights Network website, Steve just revamped the whole thing. It's really wonderful. And go to the middle of the page, and you'll see the AZ Family CNN report. We got a message that right before the third anniversary, that on March 8th, three Air National Guards were coming into town to send off flares so that everybody can see the Phoenix Lights. Okay, they must have been practicing for months. Well, it was a joke. If anything, it really put the nail in the coffin. I mean, they had their shot. They announced it publicly. And here, it is nothing like the true unknown. They tried to make a triangle. It was upside down. It fell apart immediately. I had used smoke trails. Just look at the report. Look at the data. It speaks for itself. And that pretty much convinced not only the witnesses and the experts that it definitely was not flares. But to date, the Phoenix lights have never been recreated or explained. And they're appearing worldwide, and they continue appearing here. Now, the other thing that was really interesting is right after the 10th anniversary, for whatever reason, former Governor Fife Symington came forward bravely to disclose that he actually witnessed one of the mile-wide craft. Right. And in his military and pilot background estimation, it, first of all, was definitely not flares, but which was the only explanation that ever came forth, but that it was otherworldly, which is amazing that an elected official would say that. Plus, by the way, the craft, the 10 different craft, if there were, it was a parade of 10 different craft, have never been addressed by the military or government to this day.
Wow. Someone wanted to know, has there ever been any Freedom of Information Act requests for any type of documents related to this?
Yes, the Black Vault.
Greenwald.
What is his last name?
Greenwald.
Yes, Greenwald. Fabulous guy. And he was only a teenager, I think, at the time. But he really, you know, he was wonderful. I mean, he would ask for the Freedom of Information Act for many things, including the Phoenix Lights, and got a letter. I don't have it in front of me. But it asked for information about the lights over Phoenix, and the letter that he got back is that they had no information, they had no involvement with it at all.
Wow.
That was a letter that he got back.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
Yes.
So we're ready to bring in our next guest. I thank you so much, and I'm sorry we had a little phone trouble in the beginning. So, again, you can throw out your website if you would.
Okay. It's www.thephoenixlights.net. Phoenix Lights Network website, the Facebook page packed with stuff. The links are there for the new book and new documentary and the new graphic novel coloring book, and they're all offered on Amazon and just packed with information. There is so much more to this story, and I just want to give a lead in and a shout out for Steve Lance, because I was working at the Arizona Heart Institute when he approached me to do a film, and I wanted to so badly, after producing video workbook curriculums on vital health issues, which are currently when they won all kinds of awards, are currently being distributed by Discovery Education, but I didn't have any time. I was working 7 to 7 at the Heart Institute, doing radio programs like this into the night, and the weekends Barnes & Noble and Borders tours, and then I was invited to a school. I just want to share this because I'm working on a curriculum too for 4th to 12th grade. Because I walked in, I couldn't believe they invited me to talk about this at a middle school. 200 middle school students, you could hear a pin drop. They thirst for this knowledge. And I realized, my goodness, there is nothing in our history books about this. And Steve was very persistent, and he said he was coming in to see his parents who lived here. His father's a doctor, and bring in his equipment. And I said, wait a minute. I said, I stayed anonymous for 7 years, and I take confidentiality very seriously. I don't know if the other people that shared their stories with me, and even the professors at the universities who could lose their grants, would do this. And every single person except one who came aboard later enthusiastically said that they would. And it was really a sign. And we started filming, and by the summer, I mean, I had to make a choice, and I have to tell you, working with Steve was just such a joy. He is so talented and so brilliant in so many ways, and if you just look at the website, you'll see, and certainly the documentary as well. Talk about a grassroots effort. Martin, the two of us did this from our own hearts and pockets, and certainly we couldn't have done it without the participation of so many wonderful people in the documentary. Many have passed, by the way. There's a handful that have passed, including astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell, who was wonderful and
right.
talks about
Steve's,
the cover-up in the... In,
Steve's
in
trying
the,
to get through, so...
Go ahead. Okay.
Thanks so much.
Okay, so thank you so much for having me, and have a great conversation with Steve, and just want to tell everybody, keep looking up.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks, Martin. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Steve, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
You're there. Oh, get a little closer to your phone if you would.
Okay.
Yes, welcome to the show. And so we just had, just let you know, we had a conversation first with Francis, then with Lynn. Basically covered everything. What was your, why don't you give your background first, and then wanted to know what your interest was in the Phoenix Lights, actually.
Well, actually, I've been studying UFOs since I was a little kid. I got interested at about age 10 or 11 and started reading a lot of books on them, and I was inspired by a lot of movies like Close Encounters and E.T. and watched just about every TV show that they've ever had on it, like Sightings and what was the other one? Unsolved Mysteries. There's a lot of great shows on it. So I've been following it for a long time and always had an interest in it. And it was just through a matter of circumstances that I happened to be introduced to Lynn by Paul Perry, who is an author who wrote a foreword in Lynn's book, The Phoenix Lights. Mm-hmm. And he had contacted me regarding another project and asked me if I had any interest in doing a film on UFOs. And I said, yeah, I think I would be interested in that. And he put me in touch with Dr. Lynn, and we ended up going out to lunch one day, and she showed me all of her photographs. And I said, well, it looks like we've got some material to work with here. And I said, but, you know, if you think you can get some people to speak out about this and get some witnesses, then we can move forward on this. And within a couple of weeks, she had found quite a number of witnesses that were willing to speak on camera and tell their story. So that's kind of how we got involved with this. It just kind of, you know, kind of started very organically, and then it just kind of built up from there and just got bigger and bigger and bigger. So that's kind of how it got all, that's all how it got started.
Yeah. Now you were actually involved in some personal interviews with witnesses, a lot of them?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, we interviewed I can't remember how many witnesses, quite a few. Not everybody made it into the final cut. I mean, our first cut was like almost 4 hours.
Wow.
So we had to cut out a lot of people, a lot of materials to get it down to 85 minutes. But yeah, we interviewed quite a few witnesses. I was there with every interview. Now, I've also interviewed people who never made it into the film that we never even interviewed. For example, I was on a flight from Phoenix going back to Sacramento, and I was sitting next to a gentleman, and we kind of got to talking, and he asked me what I did. I said, I'm a filmmaker. And he goes, oh, what are you working on? And I said, well, I'm working on the Phoenix Lights. And he goes, oh, well, I saw the Phoenix Lights. And it turns out he was an off-duty Southwest Airlines pilot who had actually seen at least one of these craft during the time that it flew over Phoenix. So I got all excited, and I said, hey, would you want to appear on camera? You know, we'll even disguise your voice and blur out your face. Well, as soon as I asked him that, he stonewalled me the rest of the flight. It was like a wall went up between us. He never said another word to me.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, which is interesting. And I'm a licensed pilot myself. I've spoken to a lot of pilots off the record, and they've all been very willing to share their stories with me privately, but they're all afraid to talk about it in any kind of public way. In fact, it was interesting. I had a presentation at a pilot's meeting and was just demonstrating flight simulators and that kind of thing. And the guy who invited me to talk said, hey, when you're done talking, maybe you should ask, you know, if anybody, because this is like a room full of pilots, ask if anybody has had any weird sightings. And I was like, I really didn't want to do it. But at the end, he kind of goaded me into doing it. So I stood up in front of all these pilots. There must have been about 50 of them. I said, well, you know, by the way, you know, have any of you ever seen anything strange in the skies? Well, the only thing I heard was a lone cricket in the back of the room. And as soon as the meeting was over and everybody was dispersing, I had at least one pilot come up to me and goes, you know, actually, I did have a sighting. And I'm like, well, why didn't you speak up? Why didn't you say something? You know, I mean, it's like they don't, you know, none of these pilots want to talk about any of this stuff publicly.
Right.
I also spoke to the air traffic controller who was on duty the night of the Phoenix Lights. I tried desperately to get him into the film, but as he said, he actually, the first time I talked to him, he said, well, I'll think about it, and I'll call you back in a couple of weeks. I thought I would never hear from him again, but amazingly, he did call me back 2 weeks later, and he said, well, I thought about it, but I don't want to appear on camera. And basically, he was afraid of jeopardizing his job.
Yeah.
And I'd even spoken to Trick Johnson myself, along with some other people. We were doing some research in a project that we're thinking of producing and met with him at his house, and he told him about his sighting, and he saw this massive craft as it flew over, and he's a professional pilot, and he was retired at the time. And we asked him if he'd want to be involved and be on camera, and he completely outright said no. He does not want to be on camera, didn't want to speak about it. And here this guy's retired, so he doesn't have to worry about being fired, but you know, he didn't want to talk about it. And I could go on and on. There's been many cases of pilots who've seen the Phoenix Lights who would never go on record, whether it was to be written in, you know, Lynn's book or appear on camera for the documentary. It's like, when it came to that, it was like, nope, they don't want to speak about it.
Yes.
So,
yes.
You know, that's a tough thing. And the thing is, pilots are some of the best witnesses we have. They understand our airspace. And what's really ridiculous about it is that a pilot should be able to report an unidentified flying object in their airspace.
I would think so.
Unidentified, right? Mm-hmm. You know, nobody's saying it's alien, and just there's something in their airspace that shouldn't be there. And yet, they can't speak about it. Or if they do, you know, they're told not to speak about it publicly. There's all kinds of cases. We had a French pilot in World War II who had actually seen these Foo Fighters, which are these little orbs of light that have been commonly spotted during certain times during World War II. And he was told by his commanding officer never to speak of it. So you see, there's just this pattern. It just goes on and on and on. And it's a shame because pilots are really some of the best witnesses we have on these types of things.
Yes, I have a good friend that's an international commercial pilot. And so we speak, and I told him I did this show, and I asked him if he had ever seen anything. He said no, but he has a friend that talks about a sighting all the time in the air, you know, while he was flying. And so I'm trying to get him to talk, but I think I'm running into the same type of thing. He's not showing any interest at all in speaking about
it.
And it's a career killer, I guess, huh?
Yeah, and it, you know, when you think about it, it's kind of ridiculous. Why would it be?
Yeah.
Because just because you're reporting an unidentified flying object doesn't mean you're saying it's alien.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean that you're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, you know, from what I hear, from what I've read, these pilots, what they've been told from the, you know, the upper brass, is they don't want the general public to find out that they have pilots who believe in UFOs, because, of course, that makes them crazy. And nobody wants to fly the crazy airline with crazy pilots.
Yeah.
Which is ludicrous. Which is the last time anybody has ever called the airlines to find out who their pilots are. They're going to, you know, fly back east to see Aunt Sally. Well, I'm going to find out who my pilots are, and I'm going to do a background check on them, and I'm going to make sure that none of them ever spoke about ever seeing a UFO, because we all know that UFO means alien.
Yeah.
And then, of course, that would make them crazy, and I'm not going to get on that flight if there's a crazy pilot. It doesn't happen. It's ludicrous.
Right.
So when something doesn't make sense, it's because you don't know the whole picture. There's a big piece of the picture that's missing, and so you're looking at something that makes no sense at all. But when you look at it on a bigger picture, there are those very powerful people who don't want this to come out. And they want to maintain their power and control, and they're going to do everything they can to try to squash the whole subject to the point of threatening pilots that they're going to lose their jobs, you know, all of this kind of stuff. I mean, why would Frances Barwood be made fun of in the media when all she did was inquire? What was this that flew through our airspace? It's a perfectly logical question to ask.
Yeah, and she didn't understand why, and I don't blame her. You know, I mean, it doesn't make any sense why, you know, why she'd be ridiculed for that. By the way, she texted me while we were talking here and just said that your film is the best in chronological order, and she just thought you did a wonderful job with that.
Oh, well, I appreciate her saying that. Yeah, we tried to make it as authentic and as truthful as possible. We really gave witnesses a chance to really speak honestly about what they saw. And the thing is, when you've got witness after witness after witness all describing the same thing, you have to give credence to that.
Yeah.
Now, furthermore, I'll say that when you speak to an air traffic controller who tells you flat out that he didn't know, he saw the lights, but he didn't know what they were and they didn't appear on radar, but they went right through the middle of Sky Harbor airspace, you have to really seriously ask the question, what the heck was that?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I don't know if people know this, most people aren't pilots, so they don't understand that you know, airspace is very controlled, especially around a busy city like Phoenix, because you've got you know, Sky Harbor Airport with a lot of flights going in and out. And by the way, this was just business as usual. There were dozens and dozens of planes in the air at any given time, as it would be on any typical night. And you've got all these satellite airports around, so there's a lot of traffic. To suggest that, you know, I mean, whatever this was, it totally violated Class Bravo airspace, which is about a 30-mile, roughly, it's a 30-mile ring, if you want to think of it that way, like a circle that surrounds Sky Harbor Airport. You can't really enter that space unless you have a transponder and MOTC reporting, which is altitude, you know, reporting, and you're not allowed to enter that airspace without a clearance from the air traffic controller. So whatever it was didn't have clearance. It flew right through the middle of Class Bravo airspace and then disappeared. So, you know, you have to ask, what was that?
Right.
And some people might say, well, maybe it was military. And just for the record, you know, the military can't fly willy-nilly wherever they want to go. They have to follow the airspace rules like everybody else. They have special MOAs, which is called a military operations area, that operates during certain times. It's published. They have special airways that they can follow. But, you know, all of this stuff is posted, and you know, you can get NOTAMs, which is a notice to airmen, and you know, find out about what type of military operations are going on. But they can't just fly into a city and fly through Class Bravo airspace without calling in, without getting clearance.
Yeah.
So I don't believe this was military at all. And the second reason I don't believe it is because the craft, all the reports from everybody who saw it said that it was enormous. I mean, some people described it as being a mile wide, like was mentioned earlier. One pilot said that it was big enough to land his plane on. So, you know, I don't believe the military has anything that big. I can't believe that they would intentionally fly something that big, even if they had something like that, through the middle of a busy airspace and take a chance on mid-air collisions and, you know, God knows what could have happened if it had crashed. I mean, it just, you know, there's no way that would have happened.
Yeah.
You know, it just kills the whole military craft idea altogether.
Right. There's a question that came in on the forum, and Carrie wanted to know, if this event were to happen in present day, do you think there would be a different outcome compared to 20 years ago?
Oh, well, the first thing that comes to my mind is the fact that everybody's got cell phones and iPhones and with
social
video
media
capability and social yeah. media. So first of all, you've got lots of cameras that would be pointing at the sky and capturing whatever it was from all different angles. And secondly, you'd have the social media where it would be spread across the World Wide Web in seconds and minutes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, everybody around the world would know about it. So these are two very, very big differences between if it were to happen today versus back in 1997.
Right, right. You know, there was internet back then, but it wasn't very good at all, from what I remember.
Nothing like this.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing like what we have now. And, you know, we barely even had, I mean, they just barely started to create, like, chat rooms. Like, the Phoenix Lights kind of was at the very beginning of all of that, where they would have chat rooms, you know,
yeah.
talking about, you know, these types of sightings. So
right.
it was very much in the early days of all of that. And, you know, and also video and just the speed of the internet and, you know, I remember building websites back then and just trying to do some simple videos and post them, and they had to be so pixelated and such and low res. I mean, you just couldn't. It's not like now where you can stream and watch things in HD. I mean, it was,
yeah.
you know, very much back in the old dinosaur days. You know, as far as video and stuff like that.
Right. So, what's your theory on why this craft made such a public appearance that night, or crafts?
I can only speculate, but, you know, my gut feeling is that this was a way for, I believe that open contact's going to happen sooner or later. Seems like it's more later than sooner, unfortunately, but I think that it's a very delicate process. I don't think they're just going to, you know, land on the White House lawn and say, hey, here we are. I don't think it's that simple. I think this has to be a slow process where they have many sightings. And it kind of stirs up the pot and gets people talking about it. And I think that this was also a way for them to test the waters, to see what the response would be. How would it trickle down through the media and through, how would the government handle it? You know, how would society as a whole you know, accept this. And I think that, you know, again, this is just my theory, right? But I think that once humanity as a whole reaches a certain level of enlightenment, then it's kind of the tipping point where they can finally come out and say, here we are, we can finally have open contact. So that's just, you know, like, again, I can only speculate on that, as anybody can, but it seems fairly logical. And I think that it could very well happen again.
Yeah, sure.
Especially, I try to keep my cameras ready.
Yeah, right.
Just in case.
Yeah. And the people that were talking about telepathic messages, is that the most unusual part of what you observed with the witnesses, or was there something even more unusual?
You know, most people, you know, for me, the most unusual ones, the sightings, were the people who were directly underneath this craft when it flew over. We didn't really have it. It wasn't too much in the way of telepathic situations, but, you know, when you talk about the witnesses who were directly underneath and looking up at this massive, huge craft that looked like it was cloaking, like the way a craft would cloak if you've ever watched Star Trek or even Star Wars, you know, that it looks all wavy and energy, like energy, and you can kind of see through it and kind of like wavy glass. And that's what they were seeing as they were looking through it. They could still see the stars, but they were distorted by this kind of a, you know, almost like a force field looking thing. But the lights were all very rigid in formation relatively to each other. But being directly underneath, to me, is what's so compelling about the stories, because it wasn't like they were looking at these lights from a distance and trying to figure out what they were. They were directly underneath, and they could see that it wasn't a plane, you know, that it wasn't anything conventional, and it was huge. It just kept going on and on and on. So, and just, if I could just make a quick segue into a couple sightings of my own. Telepathic communication, so I'm going to throw out a couple of sightings I've had. First of all, I did see orbs over Phoenix on November 21st, 2005. And there were some very strange circumstances that led to us getting on a flight, which had a layover in Phoenix. We were never even supposed to be on that flight, but it was just some weird circumstances that got us on there. We ended up leaving Phoenix at about the same time, roughly 8:30, when the Phoenix lights started flying over the Phoenix area. And I had been looking out the window, as I always did. I was always looking for them, and I was kind of asking, you know, could you guys make another appearance here? I'd love to, you know, see you, you know. They must have heard me, because as I was looking out my window, I suddenly see these two orbs show up. And I'm guessing maybe half a mile, maybe a mile at the most. It wasn't that far away from our aircraft. We were actually taking off over Glendale, which is kind of west of Phoenix, and flying northwest out of Phoenix towards Sacramento. And so I saw these two orbs side by side, exactly like they've been depicted in film and pictures. And they were there for a little while, and then they faded out. And then a short time later, three F-16s went flying by. And then they came back on again in the same place. So I was like, okay, how do you figure that? And they definitely weren't flares. They didn't look like flares. And also, it was over a populated area. They're not allowed to drop flares over populated areas. So I watched them. They were drifting back. It got to the point where I couldn't watch them anymore. And then they reappeared again. And by this time, we were over Sun City, which is kind of northwest Phoenix. And came on again. I watched them again and watched them for a little while. And then when I was kind of satisfied that, you know, I kind of looked at them enough, I mean, you'd think that you'd just look at them forever, but I thought, well, okay, I've kind of studied them all I can right now. So as soon as I thought that, they faded out and went away. And several years later, I saw two orbs again over Grass Valley, and I started seeing a lot of orbs after that. But the two significant orb sightings, getting to the telepathic one, I was up in my office. We had a separate guest house where I had my office and the garage below, which was separate from the main house. I was up there finishing up my emails, and I got this voice in my head. Now, I've never had telepathic communication before, but all I can say is it was this loud voice that came into my head, and it wasn't my thoughts. It was telling me to go outside and look up in the sky. And I heard it several times. I thought, okay, so I stopped what I was doing. I went down the stairs. I walked out the door. I looked up in the sky. As soon as I did that, an orb flew over my house at low altitude. It was completely silent. And I don't have any fear. I kind of feel like, you know, we're all one big family in this universe, so I don't have any fear. I just did my, you know, peace, love gesture, and as soon as I did that, it lit up super bright. It, like, powered up. And so it lit up super bright, dimmed back down, and then just took off. And it happened again about a week or so later. I was in the house. We were getting ready to settle in and watch TV. I hear that voice again in my head, and I thought, oh, okay, I guess I better go outside. I went out there, and sure enough, same thing happened again. And I did my peace love gesture, lit up super bright, and went on. And I thought that was pretty darn amazing. And of course, that is very difficult to explain as far as any, you know, any skeptics. I mean, what could possibly do something like that? You get a voice in your head, you go outside, something flies over your house and lights up, and, you know, how do you explain that?
Well, you know, you're not alone, because I've heard of that before.
Really?
As a matter of fact, there's an old-time researcher, been on the show many times, that has gotten a feeling, you know, just like a feeling, and he'd even, like, you know, make sure his camera was near him. You know, so you're not alone, and I think I've heard a few other people mention something not quite like yours, but like they knew they were going to see something.
Yeah. Well, I know I wasn't the only one that saw it. Well, there was one night where we were out stargazing, and it was a orb that flew at very high altitude over our house. And when it was directly overhead, it lit up super bright, powered up, continued on its path. And I thought, wow, you know, that's really cool. Now, this was before I had the two telepathic ones. Hmm. A friend of mine up in Vancouver, Washington, sent me a video, a YouTube video. I just said, check this out. Now, she didn't know about my sighting. I watched the video, and some guy apparently up in Washington State, I was using a night vision camera, and captured exactly what I saw. It was a high-altitude orb that flew over. It lit up super bright. And I thought, wow, that's exactly what I saw. And I was actually sending the link around to some friends saying, this is what I saw the other night. And I was, it wasn't too long when they, maybe a week or so after it came out, that they pulled the video off of YouTube.
Wow. Hey, you know, I can't believe this, but we're out of time already. Can tell us, I know that went very fast. Can you tell us where someone would see the film?
I'm sorry, what was your question?
The film, the Phoenix Lights film. How could the listener see that, watch that film?
Oh, the documentary?
Yes.
Well, it's on Netflix. Beyond Top Secret, you can go to Netflix and rent it off of Netflix. So that's probably the best way to get it.
All right, excellent. Hey, thanks
and
so much.
And you can also buy it. You can go to thephoenixlights.net and purchase it online.
Great. Thanks so much, Steve. It's been a real pleasure. I'm sorry it had
to
be so
you.
Short.
Well, thank you. Went by fast.
All right. Okay, you take
thank
care.
Thank you so much.
Thanks
bye-bye.
A lot. Okay, yeah. Bye-bye. All right, everyone. So that's it for our guests, and that's it for the show. Thanks so much for hanging in and watching live on YouTube. And if you're a supporter, thank you so much. And next week, we'll be back with John Burroughs from the Rendlesham Forest incident. Remember, if you want to support the show, you can get to listen to the Everything Else show as a podcast as well. Again, thanks so much, everyone. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.